This month, The Spectator becomes the first magazine in history to print 10,000 issues, and we'd like to celebrate with you. Subscribe to The Spectator for 12 weeks for just £12. Plus, we'll send you a bottle of commemorative Spectator gin, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/celebrate.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, The Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Katie Balls and I'm joined by Fraser Nelson and James Forsyth. Last night, the Prime Minister was admitted to intensive care as a result of his escalating coronavirus symptoms. James, what's the update on the Prime Minister's condition?
So we just heard from Michael Gove this morning on the Today programme, and he was saying that the Prime Minister remains in hospital in intensive care. He's received oxygen support, but he is not currently on a ventilator.
Fraser, clearly it's a very worrying escalation. Although the suggestion last night was that the Prime Minister had been admitted to intensive care as a precautionary measure, to be admitted in the first place is very serious. It doesn't feel as though this is completely preemptive.
Well, that's precisely what's worrying so many people in government. I mean, on Sunday night, when they said he was going in for tests, people thought that was exactly what it was. That, sure, he's a rather important person, so maybe his tests will be administered in the hospital rather than number 10. And then we go from a situation where at 5 o'clock he was still talking about government affairs, and at 7 o'clock he was in intensive care. Now, if you look at the trajectory of his illness, there are lots of examples of people being quite cheerful in the hospital in the morning, you know, calling their wife, joking about being in hospital, and then in the evening being in really quite a serious condition indeed. So when it accelerates, it can do so quite quickly. We also know that it can have nowhere like this effect on the vast majority of people that it infects. So there is no certainty in telling whereabouts the Prime Minister is. It's difficult to compare it to other diseases. I mean, everybody's trying to guess how serious is it, how bad is it? And there is a range of outcomes here. And I think it's fair to say that right now, nobody in Downing Street has got any confidence about where this is going to end.
James, it's clearly the case that everyone in government is very worried about the Prime Minister. Today, in his interview on Radio 4, Michael Gove said that if there was a development, a change in Boris Johnson's condition, the public would be updated. So is it the case that if he moves to a ventilator, we will be told quite quickly?
Yes, I think so. I think if you look at the fact that, as Fraser said, you know, yesterday, you know, you had Dominic Raab in the press conference at 5 p.m. and the message very much was still that the Prime Minister was kind of running the country. Now, I think it was quite clear when Dominic Raab said he hadn't spoken to Boris Johnson since Saturday that he wasn't running the country in perhaps the way that lots of us would expect. So I mean, that was the first sign that his condition was more serious than we had previously thought. But then they did get the news out that he had been moved to intensive care fairly rapidly. There, Mark said, well, the cabinet secretary had a conference call with cabinet ministers, and then it was press released. And I think if his condition does change, I think number 10 will seek to inform the public. But I think this is going to be an odd period, because there is no doubt that having been in intensive care, Boris Johnson, as he hopefully will, leaves hospital soon, he will need a period of convalescence. I think there is a feeling among some of the Prime Minister's friends that it was maybe a mistake for him to be so keen to kind of carry on working, even with a stripped back diary last week. Maybe it would have been better, with the benefit of hindsight, for him to have rested more. But I do think I think it would be wise, when he leaves hospital, as he hopefully will, that he takes a period of rest. And I think that is going to create a kind of question about how you run the country in that period. And I think in some ways the situation there is that, you know, Dominic Raab is First Secretary of State. That is the kind of constitutional position that means that he is the person who steps up when the Prime Minister is unavailable. But I think you can also tell that inevitably this is going to have to be more of a cabinet government, more of a consensual government in the Prime Minister's absence. In that, I don't think And I think Dominic Raab was emphasising this, to be fair to him, in his TV clip last night. But if you're going to deviate off where the Prime Minister has left a plan, that's going to have to be done by something done by agreement across the Cabinet. I think what is difficult is one of the big questions for government right now, which the government has only really, has because of the work process, progress of the disease, only really started thinking about, rather than having front and centre, is, you know, how do you get out of this lockdown? And I think, you know, I suspect in a way that discussion is slightly frozen in terms of a decision until the Prime Minister returns to work, because that is such a big call and could be so defining for this government, but I struggle to see how anyone other than the Prime Minister himself could make it.
Yes, Fraser, in the press conference yesterday, Dominic Raab was quite dismissive when the topic of an exit strategy was raised. He said, now is not the time, now is actually about trying to avoid the peak. And it was a distraction, a way to talk about that. But Dominic Raab was already chairing the morning meeting yesterday when Boris Johnson was technically still in charge. He is now officially the person who is deputising for the Prime Minister, making decisions which the Prime Minister is currently unable to do. So what changes in the short term between yesterday and today?
Well, I don't think anything changes, and that's rather the point of having a deputy prime minister. I mean, under the British system, you don't really have a kind of Napoleonic model where there's a prime minister who is automatically replaced when he goes on holiday or if he's incapacitated by a deputy prime minister who is also in charge of number 10. I mean, in our system, the second most powerful person isn't the deputy. The second most powerful person is the Chancellor of the Exchequer. Then after that, you've got the Home Secretary. Now, the Foreign Secretary is always least powerful of the four people of the great offices of state. And traditionally, the Deputy Prime Minister has been more somebody to fill in for the ceremonial roles of a Prime Minister. That might be chairing a committee, but certainly a deputy would not make a change in strategy. Now, moving from a suppression to a strategy of a disease to moving to a situation where you're trying to unwind the lockdown, that would be a major and controversial strategy. It would involve overruling a lot of other cabinet members. And that is something that, in the British system, the Deputy Prime Minister would not have the power to do. I mean, I remember when William Hague was nominally David Cameron's deputy, he almost refused to take on the position because he thought it wasn't really worth going through the pretense. Nobody really thought that John Prescott would take charge when Tony Blair was away. So I think there's so much discussion about this who's in charge because we haven't really had the system where the Prime Minister has been incapacitated rather than on holiday, and this has cast into a bit of sharp relief the absence of a real British system of deputising. When Gordon Brown went on holiday, he would take all of his sort of staff and his system so he could run the country from his shack. And of course, this might have contributed to the Prime Minister's illness. When you contract the coronavirus, there aren't really medical supplies that can help you. You've got to take it easy and have faith in your body's immune system, and you've got to let that immune system take its course. Even when you put in a ventilator, it's just really buying time to see if your immune system can win the battle against the virus. So that's when you do need to gather strength. And now perhaps the absence of a functioning deputy is what led Boris Johnson to work so much when he was sick. And I think that when we come to draw lessons to learn from this crisis, and there will be a great many of those lessons to learn, we need to look a bit more closely at the system of deputising under the British mode of government.
Now, James, the news that Boris Johnson had been admitted to an ICU was broken to Cabinet via a conference call by Mark Sedwill. Is he going to be taking on an increased role while Boris Johnson is absent?
Well, I mean, the Cabinet Secretary, Mark Sedwill, is the most senior civil servant. I think you will obviously, Dominic Raab is going to rely on him for advice because, you know, there's a question about what the proper constitutional procedures are on various points. I think there are two things worth reflecting on. One is, I think one of the reasons why Boris Johnson was so keen to carry on working last week was that there is a feeling in Number 10 that bits of government need kind of riding quite hard by the centre to deliver results. And I think that was one of the motivations for him carrying on working. I think it is easy to be wise after the event. But I think there is also a question here, which is, you know, because the British Prime Minister is the head of government, not the head of state, there's not the kind of medical team in Downing Street that there is in, say, the White House designed to look after the president. And I think when you think about all of the security protections that are, for example, put in place to protect the Prime Minister, I do now wonder whether a situation where he was self-isolating in his flat and taking his own temperature and ended up having a kind of video conference call with a doctor before going to hospital. I mean, again, it's easy to be wise after the event, but was that the right way to handle it? Do you need, if these pandemics are going to become a more common feature of life, do you need some kind of medical setup in Whitehall to try and ensure that you can kind of keep these kind of key decision makers healthy and out of hospital in these times? I mean, that is a difficult question, but I think something that is going to have to be looked at the end of this.
It's probably worth mentioning as well that under Boris Johnson, Number 10's influence within government had become even greater. He pretty put this great triangle of power in the middle of government. So you'd have a joint team of special advisers running Number 10 and the Treasury. This is the point that Sajid Javid resigned as Chancellor over only a few weeks ago. So you've got the Prime Minister at the head of this Number 10 Cabinet Office Treasury kind of triangle of power. Now, realistically, if he's not there, it will be somebody else in Number 10 who's really running that operation. It won't be Dominic Raab. But because this is a relatively new and emerging system of government, nobody's written it down, really. There isn't a sort of a programme that somebody else can pick up automatically. But also, the way that the virus response had been constructed, the cabinet was divided into four separate committees, pretty much self-governing, designed so they could keep going if somebody would be to be knocked out by the virus. I guess nobody quite imagined that person would be the Prime Minister.
Thank you, Fraser. Thank you, James.